This is the State of Things broadcasting from the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in downtown Raleigh. I'm Frank Stacio, and you can watch us on a live stream from the museum from our website, stateofthings.org. You know, there are more arthropods than any other group of animal species. Bugs. I'm talking about bugs here. And although some people think that insects are pests, scientists just don't see them that way. In fact, arthropods are absolutely vital to everyday lives. They are pollinators, decomposers. They are nutrient-rich food sources for a whole bunch of species. North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences is celebrating the world of arthropods tomorrow with Bug Fest, a day-long event with entomologists and scientists featuring more than 100 bug-related activities, including lunch, which I'm looking at right now, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. But I'm joined now by three bug experts to preview this weekend's activities. Zach Lemon is chief entomologist with the Audubon Natural Institute, Nature Institute, I should say, and an edible insect expert. Welcome, Zach. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank.
Also
good to be
us,
here.
Deanna Beasley is a postdoctoral researcher at NC State whose research focuses on ants. Deanna, welcome. Good to have you here. And also Bill Reynolds, the curator of the Arthropod Zoo at the Museum of Natural Sciences and a cicada expert. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you.
Do you say cicada or cicada?
I actually say cicada.
You say cicada. Okay. Well, we're gonna fight about that then. The British always do that. But I'll say cicada. And they're the big feature of this year's Bug Fest. They've been around for a long time. How long have they been around?
Oh, that's a really good question. They certainly are represented in the fossil record going back into the Mesozoic. So they would have been an audible element of the ecosystems for the dinosaurs.
Wow. How do they make their sound? They use their wings or their...
The males have modified organs called timbals. And there's a series of membranes in which they use muscles to flex those membranes and amplify sound, kind of like a drum.
Wow. More than 20 different kinds of species in North Carolina, right?
And that is correct.
They're a little challenging to study. Tell us what the challenge is for studying cicadas, if you prefer.
A number of things. They certainly are variable geographically as well as individually within populations. There can be a number of phenotypic characteristics or traits that are extremely variable. Many of the species have very similar, if not overlapping, traits. Particularly physically. So when we're looking at pin specimens in collection, sometimes identification can be a bit challenging.
You sort of have to bring them back alive to know about them. Right?
Certainly being able to hear them is paramount to being able to adequately describe or to identify some of them.
Well, let's listen to one now. We do have a sample. And,
all right.
We'll take a listen to this one right here. Did I guess that right? Yeah, well, that's what the staff found, yeah.
Interestingly, more common in the south than it is in the north.
Really? Yes. So what are some of the characteristics of this, and how would it be distinguished from other cicadas?
That one in particular is pretty easy to identify. It's our largest North American cicada. They are typically a dark black with kind of olive green, and they're heavily pruinose. Pruinosity is the white, powdery-looking material on the bodies of cicadas. A lot of times when people see it, they think the specimen, the individual, is molded or rotted, but it's actually a wax secretion. And with that particular species, Neotibus and Aletes, it is extremely pruinose. So it almost looks as though it's been rolled in powdered sugar.
Wow. What does that do for the animal?
You know, that's a good question. There are a number of hypotheses regarding the wax. Cicadas actually, for thermoregulation, they sweat. And so there's some thoughts that the wax may serve a function in water retention or help preventing them from dehydrating.
Are there many arthropods that sweat?
My understanding is no. It's kind of an interesting characteristic within cicadas and perhaps some of the allied groups of insects.
You just blew me away, because I'm thinking they're not. They're sort of mid-size when it comes to insects. I guess they're on the larger end of the scale.
It really
so why
depends.
Would
some
they
of
need
them,
to?
Some of them are small.
Some of them are small. Why would they have evolved this when other insects apparently didn't need it?
You know, it's a good question.
Wow. Well, I'll give you 10 minutes.
Good question.
I'll talk to Deanna about her ants, and then by the time I come back, you got your Google right there. And I'm sure they've got an answer.
I don't think it's on Google.
No, if you don't know it, it's not on Google, I'll tell you that. But Deanna, tell us about ants, because you're really looking at the impact of urbanization on ants, right?
Right. So, you know, we're interested in looking at how ants cope with disease, in particular in urban habitats. So like all insects, ants have physiological responses. They mount antimicrobial and cellular defenses once a disease enters the body. But ants are social insects. They also have behavioral responses to cope with disease. So they'll groom themselves, they'll groom their nest mates, they'll also monitor the colony for potential pathogens and so forth. And
this
so,
is great. They literally go and sort of pick off the pathogens, maybe a fungus or a bacteria. What are they even looking
similar
for?
Similar to what humans do. We groom our hair. We see like a piece of lint here on Zach's shoulder. We may clean it off. So ants do similar, behaviors as well.
Do they use what senses do they use to detect this?
So they use their antennae, which is for olfactory, to kind of detect potential pathogens on their body or in their homes.
And so how are things changing for these? Because I'll tell you what, if you want to do some research, any day this summer you could have come to my house. They're everywhere. They just live there. And they're doing fine. So if you're about to tell me that they're challenged or somehow they're not in my house.
Well, this is a project we started this summer here at the museum. We collaborated with middle school teachers because one thing we want to do is we want to get middle school students involved in helping us answer these questions. And so we got together to develop ways of observing these behaviors, observing how often ants groom themselves or groom each other. And then we're also working, I worked with undergraduate students at Shaw University in NC State, and they are developing ways to measure the physiological response. So it's a big project. It's what we're hoping that we can expand across to other middle schools, and they can help us get at these questions.
Do we know if urban ants groom differently than their rural cousins?
We're not sure yet. We're still looking at that data, but it's, I just took a peek at the preliminary data and it's suggestive. It's fun. I'm hoping, the patterns will stick to it, but I don't want to jinx it yet.
All right. Well, we'll have you back when we find it. Bill, let's talk about the life cycle of these animals. I lived in Northern Virginia where the dreaded, and I have to say dreaded, 17-year cicada, because when these animals came up from the ground, you literally, if you went in your backyard, you could not speak and be heard over them. But what was fascinating to me is we looked it up and they were there in Northern Virginia, the Washington, D.C. area every 17 years. And then like somewhere in Ohio and nowhere in between. Was I right about that?
For a number of the broods, there are disjunct populations that may have historically been contiguous, or there's the possibility that what you have are two different broods that simply are on the same cycle but are geographically separated. So we do see that in the human interaction also fragments some of the broods. So
yeah, mostly we just all moved because they took over the town. But to tell us about the various life cycles. I just talked about the 17-year, and they were right on time. I got to live through two of them. What are some of the other life cycles, some of the other cycles of these animals?
All cicadas, they spend the immature stages of their life underground where they're plugged into the roots of trees and various other perennial plants, and they feed on the fluids. And for the annual species, the types we see each year, really what we're looking at are multiple overlapping generations or broods, unlike the periodical cicadas, which tend to be synchronized. These annual species are on several year life cycles. It just happens to be that they're staggered such that we see them every year.
What are some of the benefits of cicadas?
Benefits of cicadas, they certainly play a huge role in the food chain. For a lot of species, there's just about no group of animals that won't feed on cicadas. Arachnids, other insects, certainly birds, amphibians, reptiles. So they're hugely important for many species of wildlife. The immatures would churn the soil, aerate the soil. Some of the relationships with the bacteria and protists and fungi between insects and plants, that's not well understood, but there certainly could be some significant roles with that. And as I try to answer oftentimes for those types of questions, things wouldn't be if they were detrimental. So there has to be some sort of a benefit. Otherwise, they wouldn't exist in the numbers they do.
Zach, I've deliberately been holding off our conversation with you because you are an expert in entomophagy.
There you go.
Which is what?
Eating insects.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I've been doing for close to 20 years now. And by the way, Bill forgot to talk about people when he said everything likes to eat cicadas. I've got about 300 that I'm going to cook tomorrow during the festival from 5 to 7 here at the museum.
I would not have had to buy a single grocery for an entire summer if I had known
I was going to say, if you would have harvested those cicadas, yeah, you would have probably really enjoyed eating them. It wouldn't have put a dent in the decibel disturbance that you were experiencing probably because there are thousands upon thousands at a time.
But it was actually kind of gorgeous. I mean, because I will tell you, it was loud. And I mean that you could not be heard in your backyard, literally. But there's a throb. It's not a single tone, and the throb, once you got into it, was like zen. It was great.
It's like eating bugs. Once you get into it, it's fantastic.
How do you cook the cicada? What do you do with them?
Well,
do you have to clean them, or can you just dip them in a batter and go?
Well, you know, when you collect something from the wild, or if you get it from an insect farm, there are precautions you can take but don't necessarily need to. So what I would advise people who are going to cook insects to do is, after you have frozen your bug, when you take it out of the freezer and get ready to prepare it, you should rinse it in a colander with some cool water and pat it. That's mainly to get things off of the exoskeleton that might have been in the environment that you don't want to eat. It's not cleaning the bug per se, but you know, it's making sure that everything's copacetic before you cook it. Insects are quite variable, and you can cook them almost any way you like. You can put them in a wok, you can put them in an oven, you can put them in a stew, you can put them on the grill, although I would advise skewering them first so they don't fall through the slats in the grill. But with my cicadas, tomorrow what I'll do is make a savory cicada shish kebab. I'm going to put some teriyaki and sesame oil in a pan, put the cicadas in on a medium heat, add some onions in a separate pan. I'll boil some asparagus. I'll season the cicadas with a little coriander and paprika, and then I'll skewer a little asparagus, onion, cicada, and there's your kebab.
I'm actually playing a role here by sort of feigning a squeamishness about this because I have no hesitation about eating bugs. I mean,
that's good because I brought some for us.
Well, okay, so what did you bring, and why don't we dig in? Because I'll tell you what, it looks delicious. And if you think, I don't know, if anybody's ever eaten ham, if you think about where that is on the animal that it is,
well,
you eat that, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So there you go.
I try to use everything from humor to logic to convince those who are not ready to expand their gastronomic horizons that it's okay to eat bugs. Yeah. And I usually don't go the gross route first, but think about where an egg comes from.
You bet.
Think about where honey comes from. Mm-hmm. And everybody loves honey. So in any case, right. I've got three dishes here, two different bugs involved in them. And I will add that, you know, we eat basically bugs that live in the water every time we eat crustaceans.
There you go.
So there's that as well. And the third thing, of course, is that your museum didn't pay me to come up here from Louisiana to serve yucky food.
Yeah,
so it should be good. And Southern Kitchens, we kind of pride ourselves on knowing what we're doing down there. So
we're live streaming, so if you want to watch this, I'm about to dine. We're all, I guess, going to have a little bit of this stuff live streaming. stateofthings.org from the Museum of Natural Sciences here in Raleigh.
So
what we got here?
Well, I've got two different cricket dishes. If you want to eat dessert first, these are chocolate chirp cookies. I'm hilarious, right?
Come on.
So it's a chocolate chip cookie with crickets on top. And really, we call crickets jokingly the gateway bug because they taste really wonderful. Yeah. And so it's a nice way to start. And then next to that is crispy Cajun crickets. And it's a very simple dish. All I've done is oven roasted those crickets for a half an hour at 350. And then I heated them in a pan with some Creole seasoning. I like to use Tony Satchery's
really
and some butter just so that the seasoning will stay on them. It's like a barbecued sunflower seed, right?
No, it's delicious.
Yeah, it's supposed to be. Like I said, I mean, why serve yucky
food?
It's
like a nut or a seed. It's salty. It's crispy. So,
And there are detractors who will say, well, if you put enough spice and butter on something, you know, yesterday's newspaper and an old shoe would taste good.
Mm-hmm.
I won't argue that point. But except for a really good, already salty raw oyster, what animal flesh don't we season? You know, you're going to put something on even a good piece of steak. It's a little salt and butter. So anyway, there are those crickets.
I want to try the cookie
and then,
now.
Yeah, and I'll pass these to my colleagues over here.
Pass them around. I dipped in that side.
Ken and Bill can enjoy
those
as well.
This is the chocolate chirp cookie with a little cricket on top. It doesn't – now, as I bring it a little bit closer, I do make out the anatomy a little bit better. But otherwise, from a distance, it looked like a date, a kind of a sliced date.
A lot of these crickets –
it's clearly an animal.
A lot of these crickets do look unusual to people, and that's because after we oven roast them, we roll them in a colander, and it knocks off the legs and the antennae, which saves us a little bit of a mess. I mean, from a sanitation standpoint, if you're cooking, you don't want all that stuff to be all over the place. And then, of course, there is the issue of if someone's a little anxious about eating a bug, you don't want them to get a leg caught in their teeth and have an unpleasant experience, even though for some reason we don't mind steak, gristle, and popcorn kernels.
Well, the other thing is, and again, it's all psychological. I mean, you know, we don't eat horse meat. Why not? You know, and think about the other animals that you eat, et cetera. So clearly it's culturally driven. Are there cultures? There have to be. We know there are cultures where this is not such a problem, right?
Yeah. Nowadays, it's mostly the developing world where large-scale farming of poultry and other kinds of livestock isn't all that easy. And so there might be a nutritional necessity, but that doesn't mean, you know, that in addition to being nutritious, they aren't also delicious, as right. I am trying to prove. And the estimates that I've read are that about 2 billion people, close to a third of the world's population, rely on insects at some point for their sustenance.
Well, could this – wait, what am I – this I have to say
– yeah, it's the buggiest looking one, right?
It's the buggiest. It's gross. I mean, those kind of look a little maggoty in what looks like a kind of a bean paste.
Yes, yes. Well,
but you don't call it that, I bet.
Well, it's pasty looking because it doesn't have its heat anymore. We tried to heat it before we came down, and I mean, it should be at least room temperature. You're familiar with red beans and rice?
Sure.
That's red beans and yikes.
Looks like red beans and lice, but I'm going to eat it.
Yeah, those are waxworms, which are a type of caterpillar. And they are named waxworms because rather than feeding on leaves like most caterpillars, they eat the wax and other things inside of honeybee nests. So if you're an apiarist, that animal is actually pestiferous. But if you're an entomophage, they are quite tasty.
They're quite good. So they
isn't that nice?
But if you're harvesting bees, you don't want these guys around. But you can see where they fit in the ecological system, right? I mean, somebody's got to break down that wax and get rid of it once the bees go. So thank goodness for them. It is delicious. It does look pretty bad.
But there you are eating it.
Because it's like a white worm. But they're delicious.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like I said, I didn't come to serve anything other than food people would enjoy.
I'm sorry. Now, I put my spoon in that side, but you can
see.
Well,
I've got some other spoons and stuff like that. And I'm going to make sure this batch turned out well, too, because I haven't tried it since I fixed it a few minutes ago.
Is there an economic future for these guys? Could we actually be harvesting and eating these things?
Well,
made them part of our diet.
Not only can you harvest them, certainly foraging for them is an option, but farming them is as well. And what's interesting is I've been doing this since 97, and just in the last 4 years, there has been in the U.S. a real noticeable uptick in interest in doing this.
Uptick, very funny.
it's fantastic. So the number of startup companies now that are making cricket-based flour, farming crickets, particularly for human consumption, or making nutrition bars, has really just it's bumped and bumped and bumped, and it's quite impressive. So yes, I do think there's a market for it, and it is an emerging one. You know, when you and I were kids, I'm assuming we're close to the same vintage. If someone came up to us and said, "Hey, I'm going to open a restaurant and serve raw fish," we'd have probably looked at them like were a little funny in the head. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, you can't swing a stick without hitting a sushi restaurant, even in the middle of our deserts in the U.S. So maybe entomophagy will be that way.
Are there bugs that really taste – I mean, I guess it depends a lot on their diet too, right? I mean, are there bugs – for instance, slugs. Everybody's tried to figure out a way because they look great. I mean, they're chunky, right? And you figure, wow, this would be such an easy thing. But they're not good, right? Slugs.
Well, you know, the funny thing is we eat snails and we don't eat slugs. And I don't know the answer why. No. I've probably got some entomophage colleagues who can answer that question. And it's a very good one.
Some bugs that really just – that would be impalatable to most humans?
Yeah. I think that if you look around the world at cultures that have historically eaten insects, there are certain things that aren't – I'm going to put this in quotes – on the menu. Now, that may be because they're small, hard to get. They're too fast. They're dispersed. But things like roaches, which you would think would be easy to collect, most people don't eat them. That may be because of repugnatorial glands, that is to say, you know, scent glands.
Uh-huh.
And it's odd because when you cook something, you denature a lot of the chemicals, and stink bugs are eaten around Oaxaca, Mexico, and they have a little bit of a bitter taste. So if you like things like beer or leafy greens, which are bitter, why wouldn't you like a stink bug? Well, I don't like bitter things, so I don't like stink bugs. But nobody seems to want to eat roaches. And it isn't because they're unsanitary necessarily. In fact, most roaches are pretty fastidious and clean.
This was the most tweetable conversation we have ever had in my entire life, and I want to thank all of you for being a part of it. Zach Lemon, the chief entomologist at the Audubon Nature Institute and edible insects expert. Thank you, Zach. Deanna Beasley, postdoctoral researcher at NC State, whose research focuses on ants, and Bill Reynolds, curator of the Arthropod Zoo at the Museum of Natural Sciences. All of you, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up next, by the way, Bugfest takes place at the Museum of Natural Sciences 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. tomorrow. You can find out all the details at our website, tomorrow being Saturday. You can find out the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Neil Cribbs joins us in a minute. Here's a preview right now.
If this is the end of a better life, a forward road, carry the sins of a bitter fight. Our father's tone.